The matter now before the court is Waldo 2219, and that's Jeffrey Mabee et al. Versus Nordic Aqua Farms et al. We are streaming the oral argument in this case live on the web, and counsel appear ready to argue. I've been given the, I understand that the appellants are splitting the argument. Is that correct? Okay. Then if counsel are ready to proceed, we'd be happy to hear your argument.
May it please the court. The deeds in the chains of title of appellants Jeffrey Mabee and Judith Grace, the Eckroats and Morgan, are unambiguous and demonstrate as a matter of law that Mabee Grace are the fee simple owners of the intertidal land adjacent to the Eckroat and Morgan lots, and that neither Eckroats, Morgan, nor their respective predecessors in interest ever had title to this intertidal land. To facilitate the court's de novo review of these deeds, appellants reference the charts in Exhibit 35 from the trial, of Plaintiff's Exhibit 35, illustrating Hartley's conveyances in the order in which they occurred. And we provided those in packets because we thought it would be too hard to see the detail necessary. From those packets and from those charts, the points that we would like the court to know is that although the artificial monuments in the call from Harriet Hartley to Fred R. Poor in 1946, the artificial monuments are missing. They are co-located with natural monuments that are easily discernible still on the face of the earth, being 275 feet from the point of beginning at the culvert at Route 1 down to the high watermark, and are located at the high watermark. The mouth of the brook, as defined by the grantor and the grantee to these deeds, is 275 feet from the culvert at the high watermark. And that can be seen at Appendix 376 and 377, as well as 383, where the 1971 deed, when Fred R. Poor, the grantee, becomes a grantor to his son and daughter-in-law, says a point at the mouth of the brook, also 275 feet from the culvert, and a point at the outlet of a gully. Clearly by then, the artificial monuments are missing, but it still has the same effect of these parties understood the mouth of the brook to be at the high water mark, 275 feet from the culvert. And all seven of the surveys prepared by Nordic's expert, Mr. Dorsky, identify that it is 275 feet from that culvert to the high, mean high watermark, MHW, on his surveys. I see
can I start by, and these are the same questions I would ask for to the appellees. I'd just like to go through the calls, which is what we start with in the 1946 deed. And there are huge tides here, right? There's like a 500 feet differential in these tides. So when you started with the first call, the 275 feet, the record shows that it's about 290 feet, more or less, to if we use the high watermark as our starting point. And if we don't, if we use the low one, wouldn't it be like 800 feet that we would have to have there? Doesn't the 275 feet suggest that it's the high water mark that we're looking at?
Absolutely, Your Honor, because it's an additional from the high water mark to the low water mark at that particular part of boundary.
That seems to suggest it. Then let's go to the bolt. The mud flat would be 500 feet out, that bolt, if it wasn't at the high water mark, right?
Actually, it would be 1,100, and it would be an additional 834 feet from the high water mark.
And wasn't there a stipulation that it was at the high water mark?
Yes, Your Honor. The party stipulated that the iron bolt in the mouth of the brook, referenced in the 1946 Hartley to Poor deed, is in the same general location as the iron pipe at the high water mark, referenced in the 1964 Bells to Grady's deed. That's title stipulation number 38 that the parties filed at trial.
All right, and then let's look at the call that says along the high water mark. It doesn't say to the sea. It says to the high water mark. So doesn't that mean we're talking about Lapish? It's the high water mark means the high water mark and not Almeter, where you're saying a call to the ocean?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And in fact, it's more like this court's decision that Justice Jaber wrote in Gravesen, where the high watermark of Penobscot Bay meant the high watermark, not the low watermark.
And then we've got a call of 410 feet. And again, it would be much bigger if it were to the low watermark, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And then we have a total, it says in the deed, of 2.23 acres, which is the upland and would not include any of the intertidal land, correct?
Absolutely. And if the court looks at sketch three with the next conveyance out to Cassata, clearly, Harriet Hartley understood that unless she added phrase that conveyed expressly the intertidal land adjacent to that, when she used another upland description that ended at the high water mark of Penobscot Bay for the Cassata conveyance, it clearly shows that she understood without that additional language conveying all of her land that she may have between high and low water marks of Penobscot Bay, that it would not have conveyed to Cassata.
So if we find this deed unambiguous, then the next question is whether the 1950 deed was ambiguous or not, correct?
Correct, and if I may answer that question, the 1950 deed is to Butler's is not ambiguous just because it did not mention the sideline termini, because this court's decision in 1832 in Emerson versus Taylor says that the sideline termini are determined by the colonial method, which was set out in Emerson versus Taylor.
Thank you, counsel. Perkins? And although I appreciate Justice Connor's colloquy, which I think has been illuminating many things, I'm going to jump in with a question because I think you're green right from the beginning.
Please do.
Can I ask you this? Assume, based on what the argument, that the 1946 deed is not ambiguous and did not convey the intertidal land to the poor family. How do you get the intertidal land in front of what are designated lots 35 and 36? How does that come to your clients, or how does it come to the Mabies? That
we're okay. Thank
how
you very
is
much.
That conveyed? How do you make that leap?
First, you have to start with the understanding, and then you frame the question that way, that with the poor deed, the flats were retained by Harriet Hartley.
Assume that.
That was in 1946. 4 years later, in 1950, Hartley has sold off land across U.S. Route 1 to the Belfast District. She's down to her last piece of upland, and she sells that upland to the Butlers.
Correct.
Her intertidal land at that point is in front of her upland, and as you said, it's also in front of Fred Porch's property. At that point, she conveys a deed, and she's selling the last of her land in Maine. Her record, probate records are clear. She died very shortly after this, a couple years, two or three years later. No land in Maine, and the description calls for four natural monuments.
And those monuments do not extend in front of the other two lots.
No, they do. The first one is northerly, and if you the exhibit that Ms. Tucker just talked about.
Northerly by the land of Fred R. Poor.
Yeah, northerly
by
Poor.
Easterly by Penobscot Bay, southerly by along, Little River, and westerly by the Atlantic Highway.
And exactly. And the parties agreed that there were, in this case, there was a call to the sea. A call to the
sea. I understand that.
Right. And that was where the confusion was created by Nordic that carried over to the judge's decision.
But doesn't that call to the sea just really pertain to essentially the upland lots 37 and 38, the intertidal land in front of 37 and 38? How do you get it to encompass the other intertidal land?
First of all, there's broad presumptions that when you own upland and you own intertidal land,
Didn't the judge make a finding that it didn't extend over to the title land of 36?
He did, but that you are making a de novo review of this deed and interpreting this deed.
Okay, so then return then to the 1946 deed to Cassata.
Could I finish your question? No, because you asked me about why it doesn't capture the land in front of Port, and I want to answer that. So you have a deed that has these monuments. There's no expression in the deed that Hartley was retaining anything. You have the colonial ordinance presumption triggered that broadly presumes that the intertidal land is conveyed. And finally, if there's ambiguity about what you're talking about, up about poor, by poor, that ambiguity in any deed by law is construed against Hartley in favor of the Butlers. And then the final point is, Nordic made this argument that the Emerson case that Ms. Tucker talked about specifies how you create intertidal boundary lines. Nordic argued for, and on the Exhibit 66, it shows the two intertidal boundary lines determined by Emerson versus Taylor. Nordic argued that there should be a third boundary in the middle of Harriet Hartley's flats. But if you read the Emerson versus Taylor case, it talks about using that methodology for creating intertidal land when you have division of upland parcels where the parcels own the flats.
Well, let me,
here,
I'm going to interrupt you.
The parcel did not own the flat.
Because what I don't understand then is, you know, what we're really talking about is when you convey the intertidal land, are you really only conveying the intertidal land in front of the lot or not? But if you go to the Cassata deed from 1946, in that, it specifically says, also conveying whatever right, title, or interest I may have in and to the land between high and low water marks of Penobscot Bay. Doesn't that therefore convey, if I follow your theory, doesn't that convey all of her intertidal land at that point, including the intertidal land that is later in front of the upland that was conveyed to Butler in 1950?
No, because she's not conveying all of her upland. This is not her final conveyance.
Well, but there's not language in the 1950 deed that says, you know, everything I own or anything like that, is there? As there often is, in other words, meaning and in intending to convey all of my interest.
I'd like to read a quote from Nordic's surveyor, and this is in Plaintiffs 3. James Dorsky says, it's common for deeds conveying land along the shore, even when the language in the description clearly includes the flats, to not specify what portion of the flats is being conveyed. When the description fails to clearly describe the boundaries of the flats being conveyed, Maine courts have long held that the method for determining those limits or the direction of the property line from high to low water is the colonial method, which is determined by Emerson versus Taylor. So, The analysis of the Butler deed focused on the fact that there wasn't more clarity as to where the intertidal boundaries were. But if you have a final piece of land being sold and you follow those rules of construction that I just said, and there's no basis under Emerson versus Taylor to make a new intertidal division in the middle of Hartley's property, and then finally you construe the ambiguity that you're talking about. If you view that deed as ambiguity, you construe it against Hartley.
That's the problem, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
that assumes it's ambiguous, but go ahead.
Yeah, and we've taken the position all along that it's not ambiguous. Recall, this is 1950. You have the first deed, which is clearly not ambiguous, the poor deed, where Hartley had a lot of reasons to be very specific because she was retaining land on both sides of that upland that she was selling to Poor. And then when she did the Cassata parcel, which was the furthest north, she clearly conveyed the flats by that specific language. In 1950, she's selling everything, and she uses a more general deed that was very common in that time period. And it just describes the encircling monuments, describes the abutter to the north, and triggers the colonial presumption, and doesn't retain any of the land. At that point, the court is left with two choices. You can interpret the Butler deed as we are suggesting, with the rules of construction and any ambiguity being construed against Hartley, or you would have to determine that Hartley kept a little piece of flats just for her enjoyment in her 76th year of life, and that is illogical.
Thank you, counsel. And for appellant.
Good morning. May it please the court. David Callen for Nordic Aquafarms, Inc. Where the boundaries are on the face of the earth is a question of fact. And the critical fact that was alluded to in Justice Stanfill's question earlier was where the corner is where northerly Bipur meets easterly by Penobscot Bay. The court found, as a matter of fact, where that corner was, and that corner is at the southerly corner of the Fred Poor upland. The flats that go with the Butler deed in 1950 are only those flats that are appurtenant to that lot. The colonial method line would be fixed to that corner. It would not extend to all of the flats that the grantor might have owned at that time. That rule of construction would have the exact result that that Justice Stanfill alluded to, where the original conveyance would have conveyed out all of the intertidal zone, and there wouldn't have been any to convey to the others. The last lot, the Butler conveyance, is not described as the remainder of my parcels minus everything I've conveyed. It says a portion of the property described, and it describes that expressly. And so that issue really is critical, because the outcome here is what the plaintiffs own. If you accept the hypotheticals that there was a severance in 1946, then the result of that is that it would have been retained by Harriet Hartley, because it was never conveyed to the Butlers. And in this case, and in the trial record, release deeds were obtained for all of those heirs. They turned out not to be important as a matter of fact, because the court found critical facts with regard to the 1946 deed.
If we find that the 1946 deed was unambiguous in its calls, that's it. Then we don't go past that to look at extrinsic evidence. And then we're just looking at, okay, so the intertidal land did not go in the 1946. And so what you're saying is if we accept that 1950, we have an orphan intertidal piece of property. Shouldn't we presume that wasn't the intended result in 1950?
No. The court can't presume. The court has to interpret the 1950 deed under the rules of construction. But I also disagree with two of your premises. One, when you say, if the 1946 deed is unambiguous, then doesn't that end things? And I want to make a critical distinction between what a deed describes, which I'll call the deed description, and what a deed conveys. And there is a rule of construction. The colonial presumption is sometimes referred to.
The colonial presumption is to deal with where you're vertically putting down the title. It doesn't go to whether you are conveying that title.
So I'll disagree that the colonial method is the method of determining which flats. That's a specific thing. Separating that, there's a rule under the ordinance, the colonial ordinance rule, that says a description of upland conveys the flats. The flats are presumed to be owned by the upland owner, and proof of ownership of the upland is sufficient proof of ownership of the flats unless that presumption is rebutted by proof to the contrary. And this gets at the critical distinction I was talking about between what a property describes and what it conveys. You can have an unambiguous description of waterfront upland, and by definition, waterfront upland ends at the high water mark. Waterfront upland cannot extend into the intertidal zone. If you have an unambiguous description of waterfront upland, and you have silence and no reservation of the flats, as a matter of law, the flats go with that.
But it's not silent. It says along the high water mark, doesn't it? So, it doesn't say to the sea.
So it makes a measurement along the high water mark. It does go to the sea. It goes to a point in the mouth of the brook. The mouth of the brook is where a brook hits the sea. So it goes to the sea.
Wasn't there a stipulation, though, that the boundary that's used, the monument that's being used, was actually at the high water mark, i.e. the pin in the brook?
No. The stipulation was that the two pins were in the same general location, but the court found, as a matter of fact, that the high water, that the pin that was located was below the high water mark of the tidal brook. The court did that with reference to a survey. If you go and look at the survey the court referenced, that the whole area of that brook is tidal. The plaintiff surveyors, and what they're arguing is that there's this convoluted separation between that intertidal zone and the intertidal zone outside of the mouth of the brook. But by definition, everyone agrees that placing something in the mouth of a brook, it is underwater.
What was the impact of the 1970 quiet title action?
The 1970 quiet title impact really, as a matter of law, probably had no impact because it used the identical description to the Butler deed. So it couldn't have done anything that the Butler deed didn't already do. It just quieted title to that description. Now, the flip side is there are some facts that make really clear that the Butler deed wouldn't, as a matter of fact, included the poor intertidal zone, because the Ferris case was in 1970. Until 1975, the cottage was extending over the high tide line, as the court found, and Fred Poor still owned that property. He's not a defendant there. There's no world in which
he only owns title. That property if we find that the 1946 deed was ambiguous, correct?
No. So he owns the upland regardless. And what I'm saying is you would never quiet title to an intertidal zone that stretches in front of someone else's upland that they would be presumed to own without naming them as a defendant. That
he
just
wasn't
wouldn't
the
happen.
Poor or the family was not a defendant right. in the 1970
quiet title. And it was Fred Poor himself. It was still the same individual.
Yep.
That individual who rented the cottage. But that gets to the second point, which is even if there is an unambiguous description that would create a severance, what I would say is no patent ambiguity in the deed. The four corners are unambiguous, and you reject the issue that I've just discussed about the flats going as a matter of law.
How does our decision in Almeida affect your argument that the flats were presumptively conveyed?
Yeah, so the decision in Almeida is actually like grounds this argument quite closely, and so So paragraph 37 in Almeida lays out the application of the presumption and when it can be rebutted by within the deed itself. The facts in Almeida were that they'd never had waterfront upland, right? They didn't get past the dry sand. In that case, the presumption didn't apply to begin with because they stopped at the top of the bank. But that's the critical thing when you look at all
paragraph 37 of Almeida says that you have the presumption when you use terms like Atlantic Ocean, Ocean Cove, Sea, or River. Here we have a call to the high water mark. So how do you get this presumption?
That call is actually to the high water mark of Penobscot Bay. And I want to talk about that because a line in the sand has a few different meanings, right? If you have waterfront upland, the presumption applies.
Well, only if you're using language like Atlantic Ocean, Ocean Cove, Sea, or River, correct?
So here we have mouth of the river and we have high water mark of the bay. And if you look at the next sentence, what it says defeats the presumption is if you have words of exclusion to or by or from,
Mr. Cannon,
you then have an estate of land.
If the presumption is overcome, is it possible that that piece, intertidal land, is an orphan, as the term has been used, that is still out there and has never been conveyed? And therefore belongs to the heirs of the Hartleys and not to the Mabies?
I think that's what you were saying, and that's why you got release deeds from the
heirs. As a matter of fact, it's actually in the trial court record. Nordic has release deeds from all those living heirs. That was a matter of dispute at trial as to whether those deeds did anything. And then subsequent, as is clear from the city's brief, the city has actually acquired the property both by deed from the Eckroads and then condemned by eminent domain any interest that might be out there so they can use it as a park. So
what is the status of the condemnation action?
The condemnation action has stayed waiting this court's decision in this case because the because the trial court, as a matter of law, held that there was no interest to be condemned. And so rather than fight about whether the condemnation was lawful, that's all being stayed to see whether there was any interest to be condemned.
Are you, I'm going to harken back to how you started. Are you at this point conceding that maybe owns the intertidal land in front of the adjacent, what is it, Schweik? I forget the name of the people, but.
There's that
or issue. Or you just don't care.
Yeah, the Schweikerts did not appeal, and we did not appeal on that issue.
Okay. So you're conceding that. We're really only fighting
really
about the intertidal land.
We're talking about the intertidal zone under which
it's
the pipe
will be
buried.
It's good if you don't interrupt me when I'm finishing my question.
Sorry.
So you are talking only about the intertidal land in front of lots 37 and 38?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
But I do want to get back to the language in paragraph 37 when it talks about how you defeat the presumption, because that really is critical to understanding this difference between a description and what is conveyed. And those things that are excluded, all of those things are estates in land, right? It talks about words of exclusion together with something, language like beach or shore or flats. That's a strip of land. And that's actually important in understanding the Lappish decision, because the same issue, Lappish was a case about bank, and bank is also a strip of land. And in the Proctor case from 1905 or 1910, the court talks about it being a strip of land that's essentially the dry sand, that it starts at the high water mark and goes up, which is the outcome in Alameda, right? That strip of land was excluded.
Let me ask you this. If the two, if the boundaries described are at either end of the description up to the bay are at the high water mark, you agree then that, and I'm talking about the 1946 deed, that assuming that those are at the high water mark, then the call along the bay means that we are excluding the shore.
No, I disagree with that. First,
I understood. Well, let me back up then. I thought I understood you to say that the description in the deed that says, let me get to it, right. To an iron bolt at the mouth of the brook, that actually is not at the high water mark, and that therefore that's why there is an ambiguity. But if one assumes that that is at the high water mark, is my question, then along the high water mark to a stake at the outlet of a gully, you don't agree that that would then exclude
I agree that then you'd have an unambiguous description of waterfront upland. And
okay.
As a matter of law, absent words of reservation, which don't exist in this deed, the flats would convey together with that upland. So
well,
you
that's
can
not
describe.
Really what we said, though, was it Whitmore and Brown, is it? I mean, if it's an unambiguous call from the high water mark to the high water mark along the bay, then that is considered to exclude the intertidal land.
In the Whitmore case and in all of the cases where the court has found a severance, none of them are only the high water mark of the water body. All of them are coupled with what the court has described as an estate in land, the beach or the bank, or in some cases, the margin of a cove. And then when you read the case, the factual record was that was actually understood to be a strip. So when you say to or by the shore, so I would agree that if it were to or by the high water mark of the shore, that would be a severance. And I think this is an important distinction. If it's to or by the high water mark of the ocean, then that is not, because that is just unambiguous waterfront upland. But if you're to or by a strip of land, the court has said that strip of land, using regular terms of deed exclusion, that's a reservation of that strip of land.
But in Hagen we said, and I quote, a grant to the shore and then by the shore, unqualified, excludes the shore. But when one or both termini of that call are at the low water mark, it includes the land to the low water mark. The 46D did not include termini to the low water mark, did it?
Exactly, but the first part is the critical point I'm making. The shore is a strip of land. If you call to the water under, or the land under the water, that is a fundamentally different boundary than if you call to the
but
water.
How can a call to the high water mark include any part of the intertidal zone? I'm not getting that.
Yeah, I'm not understanding that argument.
So it's a great question. If you were to say 275 feet, to Penobscot Bay, That point, 275 feet, would be at the high water mark of Penobscot Bay. The fact that you used Penobscot Bay doesn't...
Why?
So if the high water mark, I was just using the example that was asked earlier on the culvert. If the high water mark is 275 feet from the road, and you start at the road and you go to a point 275 feet at Penobscot Bay, that point will be at the high water mark. The fact that you called to Penobscot Bay is not a call to the low water mark, it's a call to the ocean that the court has said can be anywhere along that, and that's enough to trigger the presumption.
But it's not, in the 46 deed, it's not a call to the Penobscot Bay, it's a call that says along the high water mark of Penobscot Bay, and that's very different.
So as a matter of fact, the court found that the point was below the high water mark, and that was not...
Well, now you're returning that back, you're making a circular argument, that's assuming it's below the high water mark. My question was assuming it was at the high water
mark. And if I may just respond.
You may.
So, and I was trying to answer the hypotheticals making that assumption, but when you said the 1946 deed, I was understanding you to be talking as a matter of fact, and the court found specific facts as to that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And in rebuttal, Attorney Tucker.
Chief Justice, I'd like to go to your point about the intertidal land adjacent to lot 36 and 35, and whether that needed to be referenced in the 1950 deed. And this court has repeatedly said that the upland can be separately conveyed from the intertidal in Bell 1, and the intertidal can be separately conveyed than the upland. And it also has said land cannot be appurtenant to land. 55 times in the trial court decision, the trial court referred to, every time it mentioned the intertidal land, as appurtenant to the immediately adjacent upland. But intertidal land need not be adjacent to any upland lot. In the Graveson versus Fisher decision...
So that brings me back, that argument brings me back to why then doesn't the 1946 Cassata deed, which says that it's conveying... also conveying whatever right, title, or interest I may have in and to the land between high and low water marks of Penobscot Bay, why isn't that conveying all the interest I have with in and to the land between high and low water marks?
Well, actually,
so that would be not only what's in front of the land conveyed to Cassata, but why doesn't that also include, for example, the intertidal land in front of Poor, for that matter, what ultimately becomes the Butler deed?
It could have if that was actually what it was in the Cassata deed, but the exact language in the Cassata deed is also conveying whatever right, title, or interest I may have in and to the land between high and low water marks of Penobscot Bay in front of the above referenced, above described lot. And that was referring to the four corners of the lot that was conveyed to the upland lot conveyed to Cassata.
Okay.
Now, getting to the point, so it only conveyed the intertidal land, and if you look at sketch three, you'll see in yellow what that is. But also, getting to the point of whether there was a conveyance that or reference that needed to be made, to the termini of...
I'm afraid that your time is actually...
Sorry, Your Honor.
The briefs in this case were extensive. We appreciate the arguments that were made in this case. And as is our usual practice, we will take the matter under advisement and issue a written order in due course. It is also my understanding that, Attorney Tucker, this is your first law court argument. And under those circumstances, we would ask counsel if you would like to come back for a few minutes and meet the court. All counsel, of course, are invited. Thank you.